Governing Principles for Learning. Almost universally, traditional schools, classrooms, and teachers place students in passive roles and, therefore, restrict choices and decisions. Choosing and making decisions appeals to learners and are essential for health and critical thinking. The common rebuttal to attending to student interests and questions runs along these lines: what do the students know? How can they make decisions about subjects they don't even know about? Would you ask a patient to guide a surgeon in an operation? Students expect me to tell them how and what to learn. They expect me to be their teacher. Such remarks miss the point and exaggerate student weaknesses. That view belongs to an older paradigm, an outmoded characterization of the teaching-learning process. It certainly doesn't fit the concept of the teacher as a facilitator of learning or a guide on the side. It more closely resembles the position of sage on the stage or professor model. It disparages the learner and makes the situation worse because students quickly become aware of their powerless status and learning falters. When teachers condescend, students tune out. No one tolerates a passive model of physician-patient relationships in modern healthcare, and it has no place in a learning environment for essential, active engagement. Motivation, readiness, meaningfulness, emotion, and application help assure that learning occurs quickly. I don't say that all learning is easy, some learning is very challenging, but students will persist if motivated. Students will crack the code and acquire initial reading skills when they are ready. They don't want to sit all day at their most energetic and physically active stage of life any more than we would like to sit all day in a passive mode, though adults can manage it better given the practice they had in schools. Counter to human growth, sitting all day results in flabby muscles. I describe children and youth as fast race cars, revving up their engines at the start line, but the flag never falls. They want to do things, create, play, interact, mess around, and try on different roles. They don't want to sit and sit and sit and do someone else's bidding most of the time. Children sit in classrooms and, aside from doing worksheets, are limited to observing their teacher and classmates. After a week or two of observation, there isn't anything much new to observe. They sit, and their brains go on idle. Sitting in rows with the same routine day after day provides meager fodder for children's brains. Behavior management of students has been perfected because, surprisingly, there are few uprisings by the hapless inmates in school. Hostility, aggression, tension, and reduced productivity result from authoritarian control compared to more democratic environments, as shown in a famous study from the 1930s by psychologist Kurt Lewin. The age of this study doesn't discredit it. It illustrates how long we've known concepts about enlightened leadership without implementation. The crux of the problem is the collision between children's need to be active, being controlled, and marching to others' directions without hope of influencing the outcome. When student voices fade to nothing in schools, their brains slow for learning. When creativity, imagination, and initiative are squelched in the classroom, they shrink from disuse. In most classrooms, students aren't even sure what is most important to learn in the plethora of subject matter content that is thrown at them hour after hour. So why bother with more than a half-hearted try or just enough to get by or, for some ambitious and high-achieving students, working for grades and status? Currently, the dominant model of schooling is a facsimile we reject as oppressive for both students and teachers. The emphasis of the present system on production of narrow predetermined ends and on objectives predetermined by curriculum experts. Our orientation de-emphasizes the concern with the disciplines and their syntax. We are concerned with facilitating the students re-experiencing their environment in a playful, self-expressive way as an initial aspect of the writing process. This approach is called either fooling around by its critics or exploring ideas by its supporters. What are the implications for schools? Am I advocating the total abandonment of the present curriculum? I am not, because there is much interesting and useful material in school subjects, but also much that isn't. Some schools have abandoned teaching the conventional curriculum. These schools follow interdisciplinary approaches, project and place-based learning, the Sudbury model, described elsewhere, and parents using an unschooling model. Such programs have far fewer children labeled as learning disabled, and graduates appear to be leading happy, productive lives. Contrast what we have discussed regarding active learning with what we find in a conventional school with its classes and grades and its uncompromisingly, sequentially ordered, slow-paced group procedures. Unfortunately, in these settings, the brain is starved for the input it needs to make sense and opportunities to test its understandings and skills in the crucible of real experience. In the typical classroom, where is the profusion of input the brain needs minute by minute? The learner needs to talk, to practice, to act on ideas, to experiment, to muck about, as the English say it. Deep, enduring learning emerges when the brain actively engages new material or reruns previous learnings when needed. Although we can get children to parrot what we have taught, learning will be superficial and transient unless the learner personally engages the content. Leslie Hart, the pioneer in brain-based learning mentioned earlier, once paused during a workshop and remarked about a sign in the library. The sign read, "If you are talking, you are not learning." Hart was alarmed by the sign's message and declared it patently false. "Humans need to talk to learn," he rebutted. "They must talk to relate their ideas, to work out bugs, to test their learning, and to obtain important feedback. Even the silent personal talk in one's brain clarifies and solidifies ideas." Although rules such as those in a library may be necessary, the pin-drop quiet classroom may signal fleeting learning. The traditional classroom model of instruction, planned lessons, explanations, practice, and testing, mostly violates the brain's powerful and efficient processes. No one means to do this. It's just that we haven't understood and appreciated how to work with the extraordinary capabilities of the brain. It seems so logical that to help people learn, we teach them. Of course, structured teaching works efficiently in circumstances such as airline pilot training and learning new medical procedures and sometimes even with rote learning, for instance, memorizing the times table. The difference hinges between highly structured learning's success in one setting and the views expressed in this book on voluntary, chosen learning. A steady diet of structured material that is not chosen by the student provides little opportunity for learning to gel. Too many people see the brain as a container to be filled. It's more like a sieve. Only a few things stick, those of high novelty and those that find a connection to embedded memory. The brain as the organ for learning seems an obvious idea, but it has only been realized as such in the last few decades. We should see the brain as an extraordinary learning organ. It's as much designed for learning as the stomach is for extracting nutrients. Neither needs to be programmed or told its basic function. Many teachers seek to improve traditional instruction by giving students practice time, relating lessons to life, and using a strategy called differentiated instruction to reach faster and slower students. The latter requires a great deal of preparation and skill from the teacher and gains meager results. There are several problems, chiefly, providing different types of instruction individually or for groups of students becomes an almost impossible task, particularly at secondary school levels. The span of differences is just too great, as is the load of students per day. David Tyack and Larry Cuban said it well, no amount of tinkering with the conventional model of schooling will succeed in achieving the potentials of students. The profession tries to tune its teaching, replete with such jargon as scaffolding, rubrics, looping, blended learning, and an alphabet soup of initials. I try to avoid these terms in my talking and writing, and if I use them with the public, I want to be called out for their use without a definition or a simpler term. A veteran teacher who became an instructional coach shared a story about how she shadowed two students in her school and saw the school from their point of view and saw the tasks they did. She had three key takeaways: 1, students sit all day, and sitting is exhausting; 2, high school students sit passively and listen during approximately 90% of their classes; 3, students feel a little bit like nuisances all day long. Here's how she summarized her experience. "I waited 14 years to do something that I should have done my first year of teaching, shadow a student for a day. It was so eye-opening that I wish I could go back to every class of students I ever had right now and change a minimum of 10 things: the layout, the lesson plan, the checks for understanding. Most of it." Her story became a viral sensation online and inspired hundreds of comments and requests for more information about her experiences. 12 years of ordered, sequential school programming have detoured us from the natural learning processes of the brain. We have been lulled into thinking that with workshops for teachers, the basic schooling process can be fixed. This idea is based on an illusion that a school subject-centered universe will create order in the brain. It does eventually work that way with experts in a subject or field of study. The organized school subject's mindset skews school missions into silos of information to be mastered by students. This guarantees little of much value in life. Psychotherapist and education consultant Ruth Bettelheim describes the situation well. The traditional classroom needs an overhaul based on the findings of cognitive neuroscience. Rather than lecturing to passive observers, teachers should act as facilitators, introducing individual students to new concepts based on their interests and developmental state. Children should be free to move around and to choose when, for how long, and with whom they will work at each task. Instead of being told facts, children should learn by acting on instructional materials, experimenting, and observing until answers are found. The quote describes traditional classrooms and their denial of student participation in curriculum and instruction. Think of the quote's power when applied to transformed schools when classrooms become but one facet of learning. Because conventional schooling conditions students to a passive, receiving a role, we damage their natural learning programs. After school conditioning, we need to learn how to learn all over again, as actively and aggressively as we did before we started school and as we often do outside school walls. We must relearn the original know-how of our brains and unlearn inefficient learning habits. To summarize, modern principles of learning and conventional schooling practice are incongruent. When I was principal of the St. Paul Open School, I had a magic hobby, and I started a magician's club with about 10 students. What happened was amazing. I urged students to practice tricks to perfection. We did shows for daycare centers, elder centers, and nursery schools. The students maintained secrecy as magicians do. They wrote bylaws for the club, ordered tricks from a wholesaler, started a store, built a cabinet for their magic materials, set up a small library of magic books, and produced a magic magazine. When the students learned that professional magicians held annual conferences open to anyone, six students and I traveled to Philadelphia for the International Brotherhood of Magicians Conference. It was an eye-opening experience for both the students and me. I had the students plan the trip, choose nutritious food, and figure out how they would endure the long drive with games. One game was to name a magician for each letter of the alphabet. I was astonished that they did it for every letter except Q. They had dug in and learned far more than I imparted. We argued ethical issues on topics of magic. While a magician's club might seem trivial, I found that students learned to research, solve problems, work together, calculate, learn some principles of psychology, did reading and writing, exercised creativity, and entertained others. I did not overly direct them but responded to their questions and needs. It was a powerful learning experience for the students and for me. Their enthusiasm and energy were contagious. I suggest that every school and teaching practice needs to pass these tests. 1. Does this practice contribute to the school's mission of preparing students for active life in a democracy, productive careers, lifelong learning, and talent development? 2. Is the practice congruent with the learning needs of students? And 3. Are the practices brain compatible? Most school practices fail on these grounds, not because teachers don't work hard or are not dedicated to their students. Instead, they fail because the entire educational enterprise is so out of sync with the principles of learning that it would be pointless to explore new paths in a preset curriculum. Teachers and administrators feel powerless and lack authority to change staff configuration, budget allocations, and other key areas of schooling. Alfie Kahn, one of my favorites on research on learning and a prolific author of books and articles, summarizes contradictions about schooling with 10 obvious truths. Much of the material students are required to memorize is soon forgotten. Just knowing a lot of facts doesn't mean you're smart. Students are more likely to learn what they find interesting. Students are less interested in whatever they're forced to do and more enthusiastic when they have something to say. Just because doing X raises standardized test scores doesn't mean X should be done. Students are more likely to succeed in a place where they feel known and cared about. We want children to develop in many ways, not just academically. Just because a lesson, or book or class or test, is harder doesn't mean it's better. Kids aren't just short adults. Substance matters more than labels. As we shall see, schools can be organized to achieve breakthroughs in ways that are congruent with how people learn and consistent with the mission of education. As educator researchers on brain-based learning, Renata and Jeffrey Kane wrote, "This approach to teaching based on natural learning requires many shifts in our collective beliefs about learning, teaching, and schooling. It will require a fundamental shift in how everyone sees his or her role and responsibilities. But ultimately, what we propose makes more sense and appears more useful for those who will be living in a connected, information, and collaboration-driven world." Summary. Student motivation and interest drive learning. Schools largely ignore students' questions and interests. The brain is made for learning. Schools are largely brain antagonistic by design, though not intentionally. Skilled teachers have been using brain-based learning processes without knowing the terminology.